This is Critical Edge. We're here to learn how to think, not what to think. I'm Ollie. I'm here today with my co-host Lucas, and we're very excited to be talking to Anthony Scaramucci today. Anthony, thanks for coming on.
It's good to be on. I admire you guys. All right, let's rock and roll. Let's get into it.
So first of all, Andrew, for our listeners who don't know you, tell us about yourself in
Anthony,
20 words or
Anthony,
less.
Not Andrew.
Oh, sorry.
No, all right, but you leave it in there. You got to leave it in there. I got to tell the story because I got to tell you the story.
You have
because,
to leave it in there, Ollie.
No, but you got to leave it in there because I got to tell the story, okay? It's 2009. I'm doing my first Saul conference. The billionaire Steve Wynn is going to introduce Michael Milken, and he gets to the microphone and he says, "I just want to thank my good friend Andrew." I'm like, who's this guy talking about? It turned out he was talking about me. You got
to
leave Oliver. If you don't leave it in, I'm going
to
be upset.
You, man. I can't believe
no,
did
no,
that
no.
To you.
If you don't leave it in, I'm going to be upset. Okay, it's not the first time that that happened to me. But
it's
you Anglicans
out.
Are trying. I'm an Italian. Okay, you're trying to anglicize my name. Unbelievable.
hey, nothing right. Political going on there, man.
All right, Walshy, keep going. Keep going. Okay, go ahead.
All right. Thank you, Andrew.
All right, but don't be.
That.
And by the way, for those of you that are not watching on YouTube, Oliver Walsh is bright red right now. It's coming right through his collar. He's looking like a beetroot. But keep going, and please do not edit that out. All right, keep going.
All right, fake news. Anyway, let's move on swiftly there. So, Anthony, tell us about yourself in 20 words or less for our listeners.
20 words or less. I'm a public school, working class. Tufts, Harvard, Goldman Sachs, hedge fund manager, failed White House communications director, and crypto enthusiast.
Well played. Very good. You missed out any connectives, any grammar. That definitely helps in getting as much information as possible.
Yeah, just firing it out there, right? You said
exactly.
20 words. Try to get
For
it
sure.
out there.
So first thing is, Anthony, when's the last time you changed your mind in a significant way and why?
Well, I mean, well, a big mind change was on Bitcoin. I hated Bitcoin, didn't understand Bitcoin. It took me, frankly, too long to understand. It took me 10 years to make my first Bitcoin investment from the day I was introduced to it. And so what changed my mind was I got that it had universal attributes of how we measure and keep score of money. And I said, okay, this is actually going to work. And it's a little soft the last couple of days, probably down 25%, which is normal for Bitcoin, but it's a big sea change, and it cost me some people, and then it also helped my business. Mm.
People often talk about technology as like a liberating force, right? Like, for example, AI being democratizing and stuff. Bitcoin maybe being democratizing because it's decentralized as well. I tend to feel that it's more about how we handle this kind of stuff, how we handle the political progress that comes with that. So apart from just its technological capabilities, what do you think Bitcoin can do for people if it's handled the right way?
Well, I think that it is going to end up becoming a store of value. It's not there yet, but I think it will be. And let me just step back for a second because I think this is important. It is still an emerging technology. It's 16 years old, 17 years old. So it's not old by any stretch of the imagination. Remember, in 2005, the internet was probably 15, 16 years old, and people were like, yeah, you know, it may, it's still a fad. You know, this stuff takes a while to catch on. Just imagine, you guys are too young for this, but in 1998, we had like wire dial-up modems. And today we've got 1 gig Wi-Fi. So got to be patient. It's getting adopted, it's scaling, and it'll eventually be a store of value, and it'll eventually be on your phone. You'll be able to have it on your phone, convert it into stable coins, either British pounds, US dollars, wherever you are, and it'll be very good for you. That's my honest opinion. And it'll be hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars per coin, and people will be like, why the hell was I screwing around with it, and why didn't I just buy it? And remember, Amazon dropped, I guess it dropped 50% 9 times since its public offering and 80 or 90% in the year 2000. But look at Amazon today.
How does the establishment feel about Bitcoin?
No, they hate it. The establishment hates it.
Why is that?
I'm betting on you guys. They hate it because they've made their money in traditional finance. They hate it because things like U.S. dollar and gold bullion has been the age-old way to be. Just imagine if you were a horse and buggy builder and a horse and buggy provider and a horseless carriage showed up. You don't want to be – you'd be poo-pooing the horseless carriage and you'd be promoting the horse and the buggy. And so that's why they hate it. And but they're aging out, you know. I mean, they do suck, though. My generation does suck. It's a group of baby boomers that want to hold on forever, and they're putting pressure on your generation, which is why you guys are having a hard time demographically and economically, because the baby boomers won't leave the stage. Get off the stage. Go retire. But I, you know, look, I don't know how old you guys are, but in 10 years, your generation is going to own a lot of Bitcoin. And they're going to be very comfortable with Bitcoin versus gold and other assets.
Well, Ollie and I were discussing this earlier, kind of the idea that, you know, people like, just for information, I'm 23, Ollie's 22. So still fairly young. And a lot of people my age say, well, it's my parents' generation who kind of messed this up for us, so to speak. That's why we've got the cost of living crisis. It's overborrowing, for example. But, you know, to some extent, I think people, you know, do what they can with the stuff they have at that specific political moment, right? So, yeah, to some extent, I agree with you. But, you know, how much of that do you think is hindsight bias?
I think it's dead on. I mean, let me just pound on it a little bit further. And by the way, you guys are old enough to be my children, okay? I'm 62. And I would say to you guys that we screwed you. The baby boomer generation overpromised, we overborrowed, we undertaxed, we underdelivered. We got ourselves into reckless wars. The UK joined the US in those wars, which hurt both nations. Again, if we're just being brutally honest. And the baby boomers got past this mantle of leadership from the greatest generation at the end of the Second World War that they should have handled better, but they were irresponsible. They were nihilistic. They're very selfish, consumption oriented, and they're still going. At least you guys don't have like 900-year-old politicians in the parliament. You put them into the House of Lords. You know, I mean, Chuck Grassley, I think he's like 600 years old. I think he was like George Washington's great great grandfather or something like that. I mean, it's absurd. You know, Nancy Pelosi, I mean, they finally hit her with a high pressure hose and like steamed her out of the House of Representatives at age 85. I mean, it's terrible. What we've done is absolutely criminal, and it's going to probably take one or two generations for the West to fix it, to be candid.
Yeah, I find it really interesting that you mentioned that we've undertaxed. I mean, from what I understand of your positions over time, and I don't want to overgeneralize, but you know, not so long ago, you supported a president who one of their big things was deregulation. So,
well, which president are we talking about? Trump? Which president are we talking about? Trump.
I know you didn't support Trump at that time, but massively anti-tax and on lowering tax on the super rich. And the same is true, though not in quite as extreme ways, in 2016. So what caused that perspective shift for you? Why do you think
Now and you weren't then? It's interesting because I'm writing a book right now about everything that we got wrong, and I don't reflect well on it myself. I think that I made my own mistakes, and some of the things I'm going to say to you right now don't reflect well on me, but you're talking about teaching people how to think versus believing things. And so, you know, I grew up as a lifelong Republican. I thought some of the policies were generally good, and some of the policies were really bad. The forever war is really bad. The manic deficit spending during the start of the forever wars, very bad. And I would say that the rise of Donald Trump, I actually thought that the call to populism, I thought that the lower middle income whites that felt disenfranchised by the last 30 years of bad policy, some of it globalization, some of it accidental, I thought that Donald Trump, and when I was working with him, I thought we were going to represent a solution for them. But Trump didn't do that. He cut taxes for the wealthy. He flooded the zone with oligarchs, American oligarchs. And he's done very little for the working class or the working poor. Now, the best thing Donald Trump has going for him are the Democrats, because they're in complete disarray. They fielded two horrific presidential candidates. They fielded one mediocre presidential candidate. That was Joe Biden. And Joe Biden beat Donald Trump like a drum. And they fielded two mediocre candidates. That was Kamala Harris and Hillary Clinton. And he beat them. And so remember, concomitant with Trump's rise is the debacle of the Democrats. But you're right. I did support him. But here's the thing. I made a mistake supporting him. I've explained that ad nauseum over the last 6 years since I broke from him. But at least I had the balls, guys, Lucas and Oliver.
Sure.
I had the balls to stand up to him and to go at him and to explain to the American people and the rest of the world how dangerous he is. You know, my buds like Mike Pompeo, they know. Kevin McCarthy, I mean, spineless jellyfish. I mean, the guy's my age. He looks 500 years old because he sold his soul.
Yeah, you still look good. You still look good, Anthony.
What's that?
You still look good. You still look young, yeah.
I'm keeping it together, Lucas, because I'm keeping it real, okay? These guys, when they lie like that, they age. I mean, they look like Grandpa Munster from the Munsters, you know? So to me, yeah, I made a mistake supporting them. Now, you guys are young guys. Maybe you've never made any mistakes other than calling me Andrew at the beginning of this podcast. Maybe that's the only mistake.
Man, I was perfect.
Maybe that's the only mistake you have ever made in your life. But if you get a little older, you start making mistakes, you'll have some sympathy for people that do make mistakes. I made some, more than one, frankly. But I'm on the other side of it, and I've been very honest about it. And I try to, talk about how to get people to think when the evidence and the facts are going against the grain of your beliefs.
Mm.
What do? Well, some people triple down. I think really smart people, when the facts are changing or their observation of the facts makes them see them in a better light, and then they switch courses, I think that's a greater sign of intelligence. I think that's a greater sign of intellectual security than doing the opposite of that. But I mean, these are great questions. Great questions so far. I'm very impressed. Let's keep going.
Thank you. Well, yeah, I guess that's why we ask all of our guests, when's the last time you change your mind in a big way? Because we think it's important to have the humility to change. And the reason I was asking was not to go, you change your mind. More, I'm interested in the process. So I guess from a human perspective, what is that like? And how did you come to that realization as you began to turn away from Trump? Like, what was that like?
It's scary. You know, remember, he's trying to intimidate people either into silence, or he's trying to intimidate people into accepting and supporting him. And it was scary. You know, I'd like to tell you that it wasn't scary, Oliver, but it was scary because I've gotten death threats. I've gotten pushed and shoved around politically and from a business perspective. And it was scary. But I think you got to be scared sometimes in life, and you got to push forward, okay? And you have to at least challenge what he's doing to the system, because you want to let people know that if you're not fearful, they shouldn't be fearful. And remember, the way bullies win, guys, is that nobody stands up to the bully. Let's say there's three of us, and there's a big, strong bully that's pounding on one of us. Well, if the three of us team up, we can probably take him, okay? And we have to start thinking like that. And so that's where I... that's where I come down.
Hmm. When exactly did the ball drop for you? Like, what was the, usually with this kind of thing, when you change your mind on a big thing, you slowly start to have nagging doubts or something like that. But then there's usually one clincher where you're like, oh, okay. Yeah, I've actually really changed my mind here. Do you remember a moment where you were like, okay,
yes, that's a great question. And again, this doesn't reflect on me well, but I'm going to answer it very honestly. I was with the guy. Got fired. I said, okay, no big deal. I'm going to be positive. I'll try to continue to support him. It was August of 2019. I'm on the Bill Maher show, and I'm defending Trump, guys. And then one woman says to me, well, what do you think of the women of the squad? Now, for your viewers and listeners, who are they? They're four congresswomen that sit on the hard left of the Democratic Party. They call themselves the squad. Three of them are African-American. I think one's Hispanic-American. Donald Trump said they should go back to the countries that they originally came from. I was like, whoa, I mean, that's American nativism. I mean, they said that to my Italian grandmother way back in 1923. It's not the appropriate thing to say, especially coming from the American president. And so Bill Maher says to me, well, what do you think of that comment? I was defending him that night, guys. I said, well, I don't like that comment. I think that's racist. It comes across like an American nativist. He shouldn't say that. And then Bill Maher said to me, well, you know, and by the way, I should add that Stormy Daniels was on the show with me, right? So, of course, Trump was watching. And Maher said to me, you know, you got to go 13 for 10 for Donald Trump. You just went 7 for 8. He's going to light you up tomorrow on Twitter. And I was like, there's no way he's going to do that. I was out there supporting him. But Bill was right. He started lighting me up on Twitter. And guys, I'm a New Yorker. So when you're going to light me up on Twitter, guess what I'm going to do? I'm going to start lighting you back, right? I think I called him the fattest president since William Howard Taft. He hates being so fat, you know? And then I know he hates being so old. So I said, wow, you're... Then he hit me again. I was like, oh, wow, you're losing your fastball. I mean, you're not even trolling it properly. Grammar's off. I mean, it's a sign of your old age. Why don't you try again? And then he went after my wife. I mean, it was totally nuts. I don't know why he does that, but that's what he does. And once he went after my wife, we took the gloves off, and we've been fighting for the last 6 years. And, you know, so there was a moment, but it was a moment instigated by honesty. So remember this about Donald Trump. You want to be in his orbit, you've got to be a sycophant. And even though you know better, you know, like Howard Butlick, I think his real name is Lutnick, but I call him Coward Butlick. So Butlick knows that the tariffs are not the right thing to do, but he's doing them because he wants to be in power. He wants to fly around with the president and hang out with the president. You know, Bessent knows that the tariffs are the wrong thing to do.
We're seeing it now with Marjorie Taylor Greene as well, right? But there seems to be...
Coming around. Mm-hmm. She's coming around.
Yeah, well, the thing is, what is it about this sort of splintering of MAGA as well that we've been noticing? Because for me, since I've been kind of 14, whenever Trump, you know, ran for office the first time, there is something about him that just is quite electric. He has the ability to command a space, you know, social media space, a physical space, a political mm-hmm. space. So there's something about him that's quite compelling. So despite all these things which you've mentioned, whether they're calling reporters piggy, right, or slandering mm-hmm. people online in the most undiplomatic way possible for the president mm-hmm. of the US, there is still something about him that commands so many people to follow him, to listen to him, even his opponents listen to him. What is mm-hmm. that about Trump that's so captivating?
You know, I don't know if you have this expression in the UK, but he's a shock jock. And so who is a shock jock? Well, Rush Limbaugh was a shock jock. Again, I don't follow your conservative talk radio. I don't know who's who over there, but you know, you may have some conservative firebrands that talk nonsense, and a lot of people gravitate towards them that are white. All right, so that are white nationalists. So Howard Stern is a shock jock, and so he's a shock jock of American politics. So he's going to say bombastic, threatening, provocative things to see if he can get you buzzed up, if he can see if you can get you upset, trigger you. Remember, he likes a couple of things. Let's talk about the things that he likes. He likes making money, which is why he's trying to make $20 billion from the presidency this time around. He wants attention. He would be so delighted that the three of us are talking about him. He wants everybody's mind on him. And then the third thing, which I laugh about, is he wants to troll his haters. And so he wants his haters to be triggered and trolled by him, you know, which is why he does things like, you know, AI of him in a mankini on the beach in Gaza, right, with Netanyahu, right?
We laugh, but it's not funny.
Or like he's dropping bombs from an F-35, and they happen to be diarrhea bombs on his adversaries while they're having a No Kings rally. You with me? Yeah, and so if you say, what are Trump's three things? Number one, wants to make dough. Number two, he wants attention. And number three, he wants to troll his haters and trigger them to get pissed off. And I think he's good at all three.
Sorry to interrupt, Anthony, but more just to my question, what is it that makes people so captivated by him, right? So I don't know if it's necessarily the fact that he likes to make money that, you know, captivates people. That's clearly something that's quite... Yeah, I'll even go as far as to say quite charming about Donald Trump in many circumstances.
If I put the two of you in a room with him and it was just the three of you, you would walk out of there feeling charmed. You would walk out of there feeling that he was gracious to you, that he was polite to you, he was considerate. He's a New Yorker in the sense that he'd be offering you food. He would want to have a rencontre with you. He would probably say some off-color jokes to see if you get you to laugh and sort of that fraternal spirit of camaraderie. And he has great political instincts. The other thing about the American people, don't forget this, the American people want you to ask them for the order. So if I was running for president, which of course I would never do, but let's say I was, I'd have to go campaign and say, Oliver, I need your vote. Lucas, could you please vote for me? You know, here's the voting poll. The American people like this sort of behavior. Andrew Cuomo is a friend of mine. You may know the name. He ran against Zoran Mondani for mayor. He got his ass kicked because he didn't ask for the vote. He was like, well, I was the former governor. I'm experienced. I deserve this position. And, you know, if you don't vote for me, go scram. And so people scrammed. And so Trump is not that. Trump will fly all over the country, and he'll do the campaigning. And he's got a lot of energy, and he does have charisma, and he does have very good political instincts. Now, I think his policies are misguided. I think the lurching towards authoritarianism and taking too much power for the executive branch relative to the other two branches is also misguided and could potentially be harmful. I don't like the attack on our allies. I don't like the ass-kissing of our adversaries like Vladimir Putin. So these are the things I disagree with. But if you're asking me to objectively look at his political skill set and his talents, I've just given you a pretty good description of what they all are.
Yeah, I think that's characteristic of populist leaders, right? So much of it is based around this cult of personality, like you said, the magnetism, making you feel liked, and so on and so forth. To be more technical and therefore move a little bit away from Trump, maybe give him a little bit less attention. I think the really important thing for a populist movement is unity, because it's like the people against, you know, whatever the other is, whether that be the establishment or whatever other group. I think like Lucas alluded to earlier, you of course moved away from MAGA, but as a general, it sticks like quite a unitary block, or it has done historically. I think we're beginning to see MAGA sort of start to splinter. Do you think Epstein and all the controversy surrounding that entirely explains that? Or is there sort of a political fatigue with Trump constantly changing position and being authoritarian and so on?
So I don't think they're mutually exclusive, Oliver. I think they're both. I think that you're describing it well. I think the Epstein thing has blown his base away. They're like, what are you talking about? We thought you were part of the movement that was going to stop these establishmentarians from running roughshod over us and abusing our children and trafficking women. He's like, no, I'm actually not going to do that because I'm, you know, there are 2,600 emails. He's in 1,600 of them. And so, again, I'm not accusing him of doing anything wrong. I understand British libel laws, but I am observing his behavior. Okay, I'm not saying he did anything wrong, but, you know, there's got to be smoke somewhere in the house. Something's burning in the house because, you know, if you didn't do anything wrong, let all the files out. He fought for 6 months not to let the files out. And we both know that a lot of those files will be redacted. But the second piece of this thing is, I think you're right, there's a tremendous amount of people that were with him that see him as a decaying political asset. He has political mortality. You know, I just see him as somebody that's politically mortal.
Yeah, there seems to be a little bit of a shift now, a little bit. And, you know, Zoran Mamdani, you mentioned him just now. He's just won, you know, he's now mayor-elect of New York. First of all, how do you feel about Mamdani?
Well, look, he won. Okay, he's a very successful campaigner. He's very articulate. He's got probably the best smile in American politics since Barack Obama. Okay, he understands how to communicate. He ran on one message, which is affordability. And, you know, they asked him about anti-Semitic behavior, affordability. They asked him about crime, affordability. And so he got a magnificent turnout. he also did better than Andrew Cuomo and Curtis Sliwa combined. So this whole thing about, you know, oh, if one left the race, this guy's unpopular, it wasn't unpopular. Younger people came out in droves at very high voter participation. So having said all that, I'm an experienced guy, and I think that some of the policies that he's talking about are going to fail. Now, but I respect the fact that he won. I'm also a New Yorker. I'm not leaving New York. I'm not one of these BSers. He won, and I'm leaving New York. I can't say that to you guys because I'm not leaving New York. So I want him to be successful. If he called me or he asked me to meet with him, I would certainly meet with him. I would certainly try to help him. But he wasn't my first choice because I think he's inexperienced. I think some of the policies, the overly socialistic policies.
Can you give us an example of one of the policies? Sorry, just to keep to get some facts out of it.
So he wants to eliminate a very large swath of the police department. He wants to further the Bail Reform Act so that all of these petite crimes and the shoplifting, even domestic violence, isn't frankly even treated as a crime. And these people can continue to perpetuate this horror on the rest of their citizens. He wants free bus rides. There's no free lunch anywhere in the world, Lucas, but he wants to do that. Someone's going to have to pay for it. He wants rent stabilization. He wants to freeze the rent in the city. Well, you can't do that. The costs are out of control. We just got done talking about these baby boomer generation people that blew the lid off of affordability and have us borrowing like crazy, which is causing massive amounts of inflation. So what are you going to do? If you freeze the rent, you're going to shrink the supply of housing. You're not going to raise the supply of housing. You'd be better off coming up with tax incentives, frankly, to build more housing. So, yeah, I mean, I can give you tons of examples of stuff that's very socialistic that I don't think will work in the United States because people will get turned off by that, and a lot of people will leave. Remember, I'm not leaving, but 600,000 New Yorkers left in the last 3 years, and the top 1% of the New Yorkers pay 48% of the income taxes. So if you have a lot of rich New Yorkers leaving, it's going to be very bad, you know?
Yeah, I wouldn't be expert enough to discuss things like the Bail Reform Act and stuff, so I guess we'll stick on affordability. I was talking to Lucas about this a couple days ago. We were talking about like the mood in the air these days. And even though, you know, we're still pretty young, I have really felt quite recently, maybe in the last year or so, this sort of mood of hopelessness. And it's talked about a lot. The feeling that, you know, things are too expensive, things aren't getting better. There's more authoritarianism, more strongmen, so on and so forth. I mean, I could go on forever talking about war and stuff. But Mamdani's, I think there's two things for me that make him so appealing to a young generation. One, like you said, the affordability thing. He doesn't shut up about it. I think that's good to have such unitary political messaging. And I think it's inspiring. And two, not to make a direct comparison, right? But Mamdani hasn't taken any funding from anyone but the crowdfunding system. Whereas, for example, Andrew Cuomo did. That seems like a significant difference to me. Don't you think that would have an impact on how they both approach policy?
Yeah. Well, it sounds like you like Mamdani, and you should like Mamdani because, again, I'm older than you, and I understand his appeal to you, and I understand why he won the election, okay? And so I'm just saying to you that some of these policies that he's going to put in place may not work. Now, here's the other thing. He may tack to the center. Okay, and what he may end up doing is he just said he's going to keep Commissioner Tisch. She's done a very good job of reducing crime. He may try to go to the businesses and say, hey, I want to keep you in New York. What do I do to keep you in New York? He's flying down to Washington tomorrow morning to meet with President Trump. Whether he likes it or not, he needs federal money to run our city. And by the way, he should need federal money to run our city. We put a lot of our money into the federal treasury as New York City residents or New York State residents. And so we should get a lot of money back. And so he has to make sure that he has that relationship with Trump. Again, whether he likes Trump or doesn't like him, or I like him or don't like him, we got to deal with him. So you're bringing up all very good points. He kicked Andrew's ass, and he kicked Curtis Sliwa's ass, and he deserves to be mayor. He got in the arena, beat the daylights out of them, and he deserves to be mayor. But again, you're asking me, because you're talking about this podcast being a way to think and using mental models, I would just suggest that people go back and look at what works versus what doesn't. Moderate policies, crime control, clean streets, homeless people off the streets, more prosperous city, more tourism, more tax revenues, more businesses. If you want to let 7,000 criminals, which is effectively what it is, wreak horror on the rest of the 8 million citizens, you can do that, but you're going to reduce the quality of life and you're going to reduce commerce and lower tax revenues. So you have to decide on what you want to do. I think he can achieve his goals of affordability by being more practical than ideological. But I understand his appeal, and what you just said is a very good evidence for why people like you find him attractive.
Mm. So zooming out from policy for a second then, I'd like to talk about like what he represents in general in terms of like breaking the status quo in American politics. I think, like I said, some of the appeal is that he feels quite different from maybe your ordinary Democrat politician. And I think some of that has to do with a feeling of connection to people and so on and so forth. And I think it's the Democrats' inability to create that feeling of connection, which has led to basically their electoral failure and recent failure over like a while now. Without necessarily approaching policy in the same way, what do you think Democrats can do to get that kind of appeal again, to be interesting to the average American voter again?
This is such a great question. And so I'm going to answer it by using a Swiss Army knife as an analogy. In the city of New York, his types of policies worked. Take that knife out of the Swiss Army knife. But if you look at Mickey Sherrill, or you look at Spamberger in Mickey Sherrill in New Jersey, Spamberger in Virginia, Oliver, they were way more moderate than Zoran Mandani. And they both won the election. And so what I would say to people is pull the moderate person when you know that the moderate's going to win the election, and pull the hard left person or the socialist person when you know that person's going to win the election. I don't know if there's one size fits all. If you say to me, as an American that's been alive for 62 years observing America, that this is a signal that the Democrats should go to the very hard left and run a Democratic socialist presidential candidate, I'm telling you, again, this is my opinion, the country's not ready for that. You know, the country doesn't like the woke culture, the country doesn't like the anti-police rhetoric, doesn't like the shoplifting, it doesn't like the crime, doesn't like it. And so, and I'll leave you with this thought before you ask another question. Donald Trump got 54% of the white women's vote, Donald Trump, 54%. He got 46% of the overall women's vote. And when you ask the women about Trump, they said, hey, I'm voting for my son. I'm voting for my husband. I'm voting for my brother. This woke culture has been a disaster for men, and I want it to end. So you got to be very careful here, because this is more, way more conservative country. Even our left is probably more conservative than elements of your right, frankly. So it's, So you just got to be very careful. But I hear you. Look, he deserves his success. He kicked those guys' asses and he worked very hard.
I think, yeah, for sure. And this, look, there's differences between America and US and the rest of Europe.
Mm-hmm.
But I think I agree with what Ollie's saying. There is a feeling. I've just, I left university and started working about a year ago. And there is a feeling that a lot of, you work day in, day out, and then you read the news, and it feels to some extent like you're pissing in the wind, right? There's just so much there that you almost think, well, what are my taxes going to? Because so much of it is polarized. So much of it is kind of this side versus that side, that there is a feeling that young people feel slightly disenfranchised. And I think, to be fair to him, Mamdani definitely kind of brings that element of hope. And I think from the podcast I've listened to from yourself, I do also feel that you do bring an element of hope as well. So based off the conversation we've been having, what do you think kind of the next few years will look like maybe from a more hopeful perspective?
Well, I'm hopeful because I think the age of Trump is over. We've seen peak Trump. They're squabbling and fighting with each other. There'll be an intellectual civil war inside the Republican Party, and somebody will win that war. It won't be Trump. He'll be off the stage. He has political mortality, whether he likes it or whatever it is. It is what it is. And so, you know, you've got people that I think are going to come to the stage and be more commonsensical, a little bit more moderate on the Republican side. And I think the Democrats are going to try to pick somebody that can beat the Republicans. I don't think it's the hard left. I think use the hard left candidate like an AOC in her district or Mondani for New York City. But I think if they pick a moderate candidate, they'll probably win the 2028 election. So to me, I would be hopeful about that because we need a constitutional and we need an institutional reset. We don't want somebody to be able to come into our system and overly hurt the system the way Donald Trump has. And I think if you can get a responsible person in that job after Trump, weirdly, Trump could have been the warning signal. You know, and again, before you ask another question, I want you to think about this. America is a historically neurally plastic country. We go through our doldrums. We had a civil war. We had a crisis of race. We had the robber barons corruption crisis in the 1890s. We do go through these spasms of terribleness. But as we're going through them, we have periods of reflection, and then we have periods of reform. Excuse me. And I will tell you this. I think Trump has sent out a warning signal to very, very smart people from both sides of the parties looking at this saying, whoa, we can't have this. And so I predict that we're going to enter an age of reform.
Neurally plastic, I think, is a good way of putting it. I think people right now are reflecting on what's going on right now. And, you know, like you said, wondering how things are going to develop, how they're going to change. Because, you know, I think it's the most basic. When I was in university, my professor told me, you know, never start your essays with, oh, this was a time of great change. He said, because it's always a time of great change. That is almost a kind of a non-sentence.
Well said.
I'm not sure, though, if it's just about Trump that kind of gives this feeling of hopelessness or, you know, relative hopelessness that I was discussing. I think even kind of maybe slightly before Trump, even during Biden's time, whether it's the war in Gaza or whether it's Russia-Ukraine, whether it's the cost of living crisis that started, you know, before Trump number two.
Well, yeah, and again, remember, if I were a European leader, here's what I'd be worried about. I'd be like, okay, yeah, Trump is one person. But in order to get Donald Trump, you need 80 million people to vote for him. So, you know, in other words, there's a crisis in the country. There's a very large group of people that once felt, or their grandparents once felt, economically aspirational. And these people now feel economically desperational. And guess what happens when you feel that way? You get angry. And Trump is an avatar of their anger. He represents their anger. And so they're with him. And he may be able to do some nefarious things, but they'll stay with him. You know, he says, oh, I can shoot people on Fifth Avenue. He probably could. You know, like this whole Epstein kerfuffle, I don't think anything's going to happen to him. Even if they find a smoking gun in there about his relationship or something inappropriate related to Epstein, he'll be wounded, but he's not going anywhere. The Republicans are not going to vote on his conviction in the Senate if he's impeached again in the House.
Yeah, Epstein is such an interesting one, I think, because the case of Epstein is something which, if you had told somebody that story maybe 10 years ago, you would be called a conspiracy theorist.
Yeah.
Oh, there's, you know, so many powerful people in the world are all linked by this one guy, and there's weird sexual acts going on, and they're all involved somehow. Right? It seems completely crazy. Does it go further than that?
I think it does, but I don't know what it is, and so I don't want to surmise something or say something that is factually incorrect, but you're asking me my opinion. Yes, I think it's going to get much worse before it gets better.
And so you mentioned that America being so neurally plastic, they have to sit back and reflect on things sometimes. Mm-hmm. We're clearly in that stage now. What should Americans be reflecting on exactly in order to move in a more positive direction?
That the Americans should reflect on that their founders were principled people, and they did make provisions in the Constitution for incapable people or malevolent people or potentially criminal people taking charge of the government. But what they didn't factor in, that they would have principle-less people. They didn't factor in that a whole group of people in the Congress that know that the president is doing something wrong and operating outside of his purview, that they wouldn't check his power. And so now I think you need to set up a point of renewal. We may need more constitutional reforms. We may need to end Citizens United, which is the big campaign on limited donation stuff from the Supreme Court. We may need to end gerrymandering. You know, I submit to both of you guys, is it a real democracy where the politicians are picking the voters? I thought the voters are supposed to pick the politicians. So, you know, we may have to put an end to those things. And then you have real reform and a return to what the original intent was of the founders, which is to make sure there was no king and there was no tyranny. And there was a very diffuse, decentralized form of government where no one piece of the government had too much control over the others.
Anthony Scaramucci, thank you for your time. You've certainly given us a lot to think about. This has been Critical Edge.
All right, this is Andrew signing off, okay?